Welcome to everyone that's joined to another great webinar in our 2026 series. This is our second webinar of the year. And today we are focusing on business email compromise. Why talk about business email compromise or BEC? Well, it's something that we've seen more and more targeting customers. In fact, business email compromise tops the charts when it comes to our IR team's engagements. Some reports estimate that organizations face up to a 97% chance of being targeted, which is a huge number. And in fact, actually, an FBI report last year found that business email compromise or losses through business email compromise were over $8.5 billion. So again, an absolutely huge amount. So definitely non-trivial, definitely something that we need to pay attention to ensure that, you know, firstly understand business email compromise, but also how we can protect ourselves. So today I am joined to discuss this topic by the top minds from our MDR and CyberSOC team. So the cream of the crop at Integrity360. And I'll do a quick introduction to the team. So firstly, we have Martin Porgita. So Martin is the director of MDR at Integrity360, where he focuses on continuous improvement and developing our MDR capabilities that keep up with how attackers change their tactics. Before joining Integrity360, he co-founded Enclose back in 2007, building it around a simple brief: cybersecurity should be practical, honest, and generally useful, not driven by fear. So welcome, Martin. We're also
Thanks,
joined by
Rich.
Peter. Peter Priest is a senior response engineer, Integrity360 South Africa, with over 9 years of experience in IT, including 6 years specializing in cybersecurity within security operations. His expertise spans incident response, threat analysis, and strengthening client security postures. Passionate about uncovering root causes and closing security gaps, Peter is dedicated to protecting organizations both now and in the future. His fascination with technology began at a young age and continues to drive his commitment to cybersecurity excellence. And then last but not least, we have Fraser. Fraser Grant is a level 3 CyberSOC technical lead at Integrity360 and is based in Scotland, working and collaborating with the teams from all over the world. With 8 years of cybersecurity, mainly focused around security operations, Fraser has experienced in many different capacities in the field, including analysis, incident response, detection engineering, data onboarding, and end-to-end setting up of, and configuring of security incident event management platforms to help keep businesses safe. So I think you'll all agree that actually we've got exactly the right people that we need today to walk through this topic. So I just want to flag just as we kick off that this session is being recorded. So for anybody that's interested, you'll be able to watch this back or share with colleagues. We will have a Q&A function. We do have a Q&A piece at the end, and there's a Q&A function as part of Zoom. Should be at the bottom of your window. Please make use of that to ask questions as we go. For anybody that that would like to turn on the captions, there's also an option there for live translation into your native language. And also, we will be running some polls, so very much would encourage the participation with the polls. And that's probably the best place for us to start. So let's start with a poll, please, Rebecca. So the first poll question that we have today is: has your organization or an organization that you do business with been affected by business email compromise? Simple yes or no today. So we'll just give it a few seconds so that you can respond to that poll. And then we can have a look at the answers. So, Rick, I think we'll close that off now and have a quick look at the results. So interestingly, 74% yes, 26% no. So just under three quarters. So getting very close to that percentage that was called out in one of the reports that I referenced at the start. So yeah, it's an important topic clearly that we all need to be focused on. So with that in mind, I think we can get into the bones of it really. So what I'd like to, I think the best place for us to start, if we're talking about business email compromise, is to define really what we're talking about when it comes to business email compromise. So Martin, I'm going to come to you first. Can you walk us through really what business email compromise is?
Yeah, sure, Rich. So I think the term gets, I don't want to say misused, but there's maybe some ambiguity around what it actually means. I think in the original sense, business email compromise is an attack where an attacker gets control of a mailbox and specifically commits some sort of fraud. The most common one that we've seen is for conveyancing, property conveyancing, where an attacker will get control of the mailbox, get access to the mailbox, and then manipulate the parties that are involved in a transaction. And that's typically a conveyancing office, a lawyer that's doing a property transfer, and redirect funds. But it doesn't have to be conveyancing. It could be any type of activity, but it generally involves fraud. And it generally involves, well, an attacker getting access to mail and taking control of a mailbox. I think we're going to go into the details of some of how those attacks happen. But I think when we talk about it, we talk about the early stages. So a lot needs to happen for that to take place. Obviously, the attacker needs to read the mail, understand where he can intercept and where he can commit the fraud or exfiltrate the funds. But we're kind of focusing on the first part, the cybersecurity part, where the attacker actually gets access to the mail, and they have all kinds of different techniques that they go through in terms of how they spread access, how credentials are leaked. So often they'll use a foothold to get further credentials because that mailbox that they compromise may be trusted by other individuals. So there's a whole ecosystem around this, and maybe we can get into some of the nuts and bolts in that. So for the most part, we're talking about credentials being compromised or a session being compromised, and an attacker getting access to a mailbox. That's kind of the crux of it, Rich.
Yeah, and with 8.5 billion lost in 2025 to business email compromise, I think we can understand that actually that is all financial fraud, and yeah, I guess quite classic sort of whaling and CFO fraud if we want to, or targeting to convince the funds. And you're right, there's probably a whole conversation to be had around the people side of how do we defend against that. On I'm recently talking to actually a finance director, a friend of mine. It's something that their team, his team, gets targeted all the time and have to be re that repetitive. Make sure that you're that is definitely the person checking always. But anyway, that's an entirely different topic that we could get lost in the time that we got available. I suppose, Fraser, why are the attackers kind of using these techniques? Let's start talking about what are the techniques?
Yeah, of course. So the main reason that attackers use these techniques is that they can be incredibly financially lucrative. For business-based attacks, of course, wire transfers, as Martin mentioned, of large amounts of money, depending on the scope of the attack. There have been cases of secret company acquisitions where someone reporting to be a lawyer, an attorney, or even the CEO of a company messages someone with some form of financial footing who's able to perform these transactions and lets them know, hey, secret transaction, don't let anyone know. Don't even let your boss know. We need you to transfer this money. Attacks like that, unbelievably lucrative financially. For personal attacks, I think we've all heard of people getting scammed with gift cards. You might have even seen shops put up large signs in front of the gift card sections to say, hey, if you're purchasing a lot of these, you're probably getting scammed. And maybe, think twice before you purchase. And of course, for more advanced attacks that aren't specifically financially targeted, it could be if any of you attendees have read Ghost in the Wires by Kevin Mitnick, you may be familiar with certain forms of social engineering that can be used to help compromise a network. In Kevin's case, it was the phone. In our case here, it's of course via email. An example of that in the modern day would be someone messaging reporting to be the CEO. Maybe they've compromised the CEO's account. Maybe they're impersonating the CEO. And they might ask, hey, I'm going to start working from home. Can you punch a hole in the firewall to this IP for my home laptop? And of course, who's going to say no to the CEO? So there are many, many reasons that these attacks would be used, especially financially. And even then, very difficult to detect.
Yeah, Joe, it's classic social engineering, urgency, authority, and particularly an ego as well. John, this is a secret, don't tell your boss. John, I'm in a special group, encouraging people. And I think it's interesting. I mean, obviously, don't buy enough gift cards because I haven't seen the sign. So maybe I need to have a look in the mirror there and be more generous. Bringing it home that it's not just business, it's at all levels, and obviously we're talking about business. Just kind of moving that a little bit on, and Peter, I'd like to come to you. And again, let's dive into it, because we've got a great technical team here to talk about it, so we can get into a little bit of the weeds. So how do attackers leverage these attacks? It'd be great if you can kind of walk us through a typical compromise and describe those stages and the actual steps that an attacker takes.
Cool, can do. Let me just get up a infograph to help everyone follow along. Can everybody see that?
Yeah.
Perfect. So talking about BEC often gets tied in with adversary in the middle. And if you're not familiar with Adversary in the Middle, that is the latest and greatest from the dark side of the net, where they fool users into signing in, stealing credentials, but they don't only steal credentials, they steal tokens, which can cause havoc in your security setup. We'll get into that a little bit later, exactly what you can do to protect against that. But prior to a BEC campaign, you're typically seeing either impersonation or a adversary in the middle attack against a high-level member of the company, i.e. CEOs, senior managers, or senior management, I should say, or pure impersonation, like I mentioned. Now, if they can't do impersonation, because there are a few tools out there that can catch that, Microsoft has impersonation protection, which takes your name and runs that against email accounts and can d then detect if someone is trying to spoof the account, if it's not coming from the right domain, which is great. Then it's not so easy for the attackers. If they do that, then they need to start looking at third-party suppliers, senior management within the company, etc. How they do that typically starts off with a phishing email. Slightly different to BEC. BEC, you're not normally seeing links and malicious attachments because they're aiming to fool the user to do it themselves in terms of fraud, like we've mentioned. However, but prior to that, your adversary in the middle, there will be typically an attachment with a link elsewhere or with a built-in JavaScript that spins up a fake Microsoft login page, or a link in the email body itself that takes you to a fake domain, which presents itself exactly the same way as a Microsoft login page. You have to be quite switched on. If you're a bit tired, you've been working a long day, it's very easy to miss. It is one for one identical. The user will then authenticate there. With that authentication and their MFA, they will approve that authentication. And as part of the normal authentication process and broker of Microsoft, it will then generate a token and give you access to your, well, the environment and your account. They then forward this on to Microsoft so that the full session gets authenticated. You get access to your account, you sign in, you're working as per normal. Most users won't know the difference. Once they've got that session or the token, could be OAuth, could be a cookie. They can then replay that and use that to gain access to the user's accounts. And that completely bypasses MFA. Unfortunately, in this day and age, these attackers are getting way more advanced. And again, it's not a set and forget kind of attack that we're seeing. It's constant adaptation. We're constantly having to do research and create new detection rules in our platforms. Once they gain access to accounts, typically they're targeting, again, senior management, or the one we most commonly see in our SOC is third-party suppliers. because there have to be concessions made for these third-party suppliers, obviously it's external domains and email accounts coming into your environment, but it's necessary for business. So there are less security controls you can place on those, and it's harder to detect. Once those third parties are compromised, when they initiate their BEC campaign, they're typically not using links, or I should say malicious links. They might be links to, legitimate web pages to make, or the company's website to make it seem more legit, and no attachments, well, malicious attachments, as I say. So attachments with malware embedded or malicious links. That makes it incredibly difficult for security tools to analyze and detect these BEC attacks, due to the fact that there is nothing really to scan other than maybe an impersonated domain. Whereas if they're compromising a legitimate third-party account, the SPF and DKIM and DMARC, all your security email security controls are going to match up, and so it flags it as true. That then gets targeted to either spread their influence, gain more persistence with the environment before continuing their attack, or they're going to immediately, because they've done reconnaissance beforehand. Typically, this where we're seeing this is after months and months of them doing quiet reconnaissance on a company, learning people's positions, learning who's meant to, who's working in which department via LinkedIn or Facebook pages, and then targeting them specifically in order to try and get them to perform actions they typically wouldn't in true social engineering fashion, approving wire transfers, like Fraser mentioned. This then gets perpetuated again to other companies where you're the target of the attack might be a supplier to a third, no, fourth company, fifth company, and that slowly continues. We've seen examples where a email campaign like this has gone full circle, where we've seen it sort of start from a third party, hit a client, that client then performs BC internally. Once they fail or try to get what they want, or do get what they want, they then spread further. And we've seen that come back a couple of weeks later from a different third party company, as obviously that's made the rounds. Same infrastructure. Obviously, by then we'd learnt and put in blocks in place to make sure that doesn't happen again. But obviously, we get alerted to it just to make sure. And yeah, I've seen it come full circle. So it's perpetual almost in its way. It's almost like a worm in email form.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that was one of the questions I was going to ask. I mean, the third party risk management is a massive topic at the moment. And how do you insulate yourselves from those third parties? To a certain extent, how do you, and as you say, it's very difficult if it's compromised and it's a domain that you expect to be coming through. And I guess, you talked about the starting with the phishing email, and obviously it's a phishing email from potentially a trusted source. Does that imply that they are, they're compromising, a third party, trusted third party website to then host, all of the login details, or sorry, the login, the phishing page, so I say, to be able to capture that token?
We have seen examples of it, not necessarily that they would do that. Typically, they spin up their own domains. So you'll see you run those domains through VirusTotal. It'll be, less than a month old, a couple of days old, no real data on it. The reason they do that is, again, this hasn't been time really for the threat intelligence community to correlate data. So
Yeah.
that web domain has no reputation. And so most security tools will not flag it. If they do flag it, it'll be a very low flag.
Yeah. And you can hardly just block all new domains
No.
as a defensive measure. We'll get on
No.
to looking at mitigations we can put in place. One of the things you mentioned there was the spread throughout. How are they spreading from that initial compromise? 'Cause, I mean, that's quite straightforward. I say straightforward. There's a phishing email that comes in from some location with a link that's taking them to a fake login page that is still transacting the login, so they can capture that token. But then after that point, how are they propagating through inboxes?
So two different ways. The main way we've seen is a internal to external, sending it to external companies or external email domains, where they're just doing a mass mail, often up to the count of 10,000 emails sent out in a minute, and they've got these mailing lists that they correlate in the background where they do their checks and they pick up on companies that are vulnerable to it or is part of their scope of who they want to attack. And they will send out emails from there. And they hide them, try and hide themselves by, automatically deleting those emails from the sent out box. They put in the email rules, the mailbox rules on compromised accounts, so that the person who can be using their account at the same time legitimately won't even know someone's there and using it. All that they'll put in mailbox rules so that all inbound mail will be deleted, so they're not getting, what are you doing? Why are you sending out these emails or these kind of replies that may alert them to the fact that their email is compromised. And as well as they'll delete all mails that have been sent outbound, successfully sent outbound, because then they can't see that now their mailbox has been sending out. So that's the primary one we see. Secondary is again another form of BEC. They will pose as an internal user within the company. If that user that they're posing as is someone in a position, say in the IT team or admin team, HR, they can then trick users into providing credentials or signing into a fake website to then have their credentials harvested once again, and that can then spread throughout the environment. So yeah, those are mainly the two ways we've observed.
Yes, I just want to point out that they also very often, and Peter alluded to it a little bit, but once they have access to that mailbox, they create those rules. But they also have access to your address book and all your recipients that you've sent to before. So you're
Correct.
now sending mails to people you've sent to before, which are actually malicious. But there's a level of trust there because all the systems have seen that mail flow before, so it. Maybe those domains are marked as business partners, and they bypass some filters, and that's how a lot of this gets undetected eventually as well.
Yeah, and Fraser, just why are attacks like this so difficult to be able to detect? And you know, it'd be probably great if you can talk a little bit to how a modern authentication process works. So I think it's good to get some context on exactly how that process works and what elements are they targeting.
Of course. So the main elements they target is, of course, that token, because that token is an implicit pass. It's basically a way to say, hey, he's already passed all the checks that we need. Let him in. And if they steal that token, they're basically doing a full-blown impersonation of the user, and they're able to gain that access. They're able to create persistence within there, and it's really important that those kind of things are monitored. So you're not only monitoring your interactive logins, but you're also monitoring your non-interactive logins for anything from an unexpected source. But the main reason that they're really hard to identify, and something that Peter touched on there, is that by definition, or depending on where you're getting your definitions from, because they do vary online, BEC emails usually don't have any form of attachment or link that might cause them to get caught somewhere or held up in a quarantine or anything like that, especially if they've taken over a legitimate account. But if you do have controls in place to prevent impersonation attacks via SPF and DMARC checks, to prevent direct impersonation. So if someone is editing headers to appear as though they're that person, maybe they don't have maybe they haven't compromised the account, they're just doing a full impersonation. They might try lookalike domains as well. I'm not sure if anyone here is familiar with Punycode, but of course, English isn't the only alphabet or language that is used in domain names. Of course, if you're in China, you're not going to type up in your URLs in English. It'll most likely be in Chinese. And Punycode is where that is converted. And because of that system, you can use lookalike characters known as homoglyph attacks to, for instance, a Cyrillic C is much different than a Latin C in terms of pronunciation, but functionally they look identical despite having different Unicode characters for them. One of the reasons this is really important is to the user, it looks perfectly fine. However, on your IT, on your web logs, you'll see it as something different. And especially in the email logs as well. So it could be a full impersonation. It's not something that would be caught because, of course, there's no malicious link for them to identify. The domain is new to your system. It looks like, X dash dash dash, and then what looks like jargon, but is, of course, a translation of those Unicode characters. Many different ways they can slip past your defenses there. And again, because there's no specific telltale pattern or IOC that can be used by email gateways to identify these reliably, there's a lot of instances where this will get passed. For instance, if there was something in place to flag emails for review, if they contain, let's say, a phone number or mention WhatsApp, Signal, or Telegram, other things that we might associate with a business email compromise where attackers might ask to move out of band, then they could even use a homoglyph attack for the numbers. A really simple example would, of course, be an O instead of a zero in a phone number. And again, that would completely defeat any regex or checking that you have in place to detect that kind of attack.
Yeah, no. And then really it's all about the golden ticket, which is that token that is giving them a free pass. And now I suppose how do we and Peter, I suppose there's two sides of this because there's the how do we prevent this? You touched upon some of the the tools on the Microsoft side. So there's on the one hand, how do we prevent or minimize the impact of these attacks, but I've also be because I know it's something that the team have done a lot of work on is and something that as you called out needs to be consistently and constantly refined is how do you detect them as techniques change. So I suppose starting with the most important part, how can we how can we mitigate, how can we prevent them?
So mitigation, there's multiple layers here, as we all know. In this space, you don't rely on a single point of failure. You layer your protections. So good things are, make it hard for the attackers. Don't allow them to just spoof domains. SPF, DKIM, and DMARC. That's a good or solid one. That's going to help prevent or allow your email security to flag mails that are coming from external, which can give a heads up to your users that this might not be the actual CEO of the company, seeing as it's coming from external. It might be someone pretending to be the CEO, or just block it outright. Which then leads on to probably the most important thing in BEC protection. And most people don't like to hear it, but it's user training. At the end of the day, you can have all the tools there. The attackers are always going to come up with different methodologies to initially get past those tools. It's constantly evolving. We obviously do our research and we fight and we try and keep up with it as fast as possible. And we set up our rules and custom detections to catch those. But there's always going to be a couple that slip through, as is with any email attack, really. And the users having examples, to base their judgment off of is a good way of training them. Regular updates, not too long. They don't have to do the full course over and over again, but just a reminder, maybe some examples of what the current trends are and what they're trying to trick users with. So in South Africa, we got SARS, we got it's the tax division of the government. Around tax season, every year, without fail, there are SARS scams that go out. Latest example of what those look like, what format they're using, what kind of language they're using, and you send that out to the users just as a reminder, can, have effects tenfold on how many users will get compromised in that manner. Other than, your typical configurations in place, mitigating BEC, you need to have protections on accounts so that they don't get compromised if impersonation is not possible. So things like MFA, and not just any MFA, you've got to set that up right and enforce MFA. I think we'll chat about that in a little bit. And then I'm trying to think of them all now.
Well, in terms of like, there's obviously those mitigations you put in place,
Yes.
and as you say, it's not possible to mitigate absolutely everything. So, what do we need to think about when we're detecting BEC attacks? I'm specifically thinking, there's, we can look for young domains. I mean, if you're alerted on every young domain, then you're going to have a lot of alerts to try and work through. If you looked at high entropy domains or subdomains, you're probably going to have a similar challenge. So they're probably inputs into it. And as you say, there's looking for non. For example, the non-English characters, then again, you can identify those potentially. What are the best ways to detect it? And definitely I'm thinking around the, if someone's stolen the token, let's assume that that's happened. How do we identify, so we're now almost post-breach to a certain extent, or the post-initial access.
So you want to look for things like IP, drastic IP or country changes. That's something we look for. And that is often a great indicator on someone's account being compromised. There are people that travel, especially if you're in Europe, countries are so close together. There might be people that live next to a border, so it might the geolocation might get a bit confused sometimes, or they're traveling, they travel for work. But if you see a UK user suddenly signing in from Russia and they've never been to Russia and you don't do business in Russia, it's a red flag. So setting up those kind of controls and then also detections to make sure that even if the controls don't work, you catch it post compromise is important. Checking to see how many mails a user is sending out. That's another good one, both in Seams and I know Microsoft has a rule for that in their email protection. A user who's sending out 3, 4, 5, maybe 10 emails a day as part of their normal duties, suddenly sending out 5 to 10,000 should kick off some red flags for some people. And that's a good way to catch them. It will be post-compromise, but also prevent it from spreading. So non-interactive sign-ins, especially with session token theft, user agents, all that kind of stuff. There's a lot of ways you can identify strange logons for accounts that have been breached, especially using the adversary in the middle technique. And then the BEC stuff, you want to kind of look for keywords. You're going to see urgent, you're going to see confidential, big, nice, big capital letters in the subject. Certain phrases and keywords are going to repeat themselves because they send them en masse. They craft them to be generic, to try to catch as many people as possible, in terms of BEC. But if it's for that kind of BEC campaign, I should say, for when it's mass, for if it's a little bit more targeted, dual. What's the word here? I want to say dual authentication, but that's not the right. Dual verification. You don't confirm with someone over the same medium of communication, such as email or Teams, if you're suspicious of them trying to commit fraud, or if it's not the person who you think it is. Phone them, have a second person that needs to authorize payments, those kinds of things. That's also process driven instead of technology driven, to help protect these companies against VEC and fraud and losing out on millions due to these attacks.
Yeah, crazy. I just remember that, particularly around that teamsing the people. You've got a great example of that firsthand.
Yeah, we did. We had an instance of impossible travel for a user. I was working on client site, and the client reached out to the user themselves via Teams to confirm, "Hey, are you in Nigeria right now? It says you're based in Newcastle, in England. Are you traveling?" And the person responded with, "Yes," and then they closed the ticket. When we got a second ticket that said, "Hey, they're now doing something that's strange," we realized that the person who replied with yes was the attacker. So, very important to also verify with management, line managers, etc., where necessary as well.
Yeah, no, indeed. And just going back to yourself, Peter, and it's something you kind of mentioned. You sort of talked about configuring MFA in the correct way, but also really MFA is not the be all and end all. And actually, I think it's probably a bit of a common misnomer that MFA is just going to solve all problems when it comes to authentication. Probably a bit of a false sense of security that many get into. And then we hear about MFA bypass. I guess, both why is it, not sufficient, and what should we be doing?
So it is a bit of a misnomer. I agree with you on that part. However, it is also a solid way to protect the account. It can be two in one. And the way that is how you configure it and set it up. Things like phish-resistant MFA, YubiKeys, for example, piece of hardware that you have in your hand that cannot be duplicated. That requires you to sign into the account. They can't replicate that. They cannot bypass that. Where we're seeing the typical bypasses again with these adversary in the middle attacks, where they're proxying using platforms such as EvilGenix or Tycoon 2FA and proxying authentications through and stealing those session tokens or OAuth tokens, whatever that may be. And the way to then protect against those malicious sign-ins now using those session tokens is Microsoft's. I'm going to talk Microsoft because majority of clients these days that we see use Microsoft and their Entra ID for their Office 365 accounts. It's conditional access policies, risky users, and risky sign-ins. And how you set those up is incredibly important to protect yourself. So that even if a user does fully complete the authentication process, it'll still block them. You're going to get alerted. You can remediate the account before the attacker ever gets into the account to either commit BC, steal information, or deploy malware in your environment. How that's done is in a number of different ways. Microsoft has a fantastic tool called WhatIf. It's within Entra ID as well as a conditional access policy area in the tenant. And that helps people test conditions for their conditional access policies. I recommend everyone to use it if you are in that space to configure it. And what you should be looking for is, again, I think Fraser mentioned it earlier, geofencing, geo-blocking, incredibly powerful, preventing users who are based in a country from signing in outside of that country. Is catches majority of these compromises. Then in terms of user agents, if all your users use Windows and now you're seeing a Mac user agent, probably shouldn't be allowing them through or anything other than that. Typical one we see is Axios from attackers. Risky sign-in, risky users, as part of that's a section within Microsoft. You can tie that into your conditional access policies. So as that gets detected, if they have a flag against their name that they have risky sign-ins or risky, the user is risky based on the activity they've been performing, conditional access policy won't allow them to sign in. Not until we have done a password reset, token revocation, And full remediation on that account. There's a number of ways you can configure those conditional access policies, and they can be tricky. We've seen clients, they specify specific user agents that are allowed and blocked, and they've set it up and they thought they were happy. And what the attackers did is they just stripped away the entire user agent header. And what that does then in the conditional access policy is it can't match it against anything. So it's technically not wrong. So it passes because it's not the wrong user agent. There is just no user agent. And that can be done for any number of fields. So again, another thing I would recommend is catch all. You need a baseline rule that will catch stuff outside of your normal use case scenarios and allow, and then obviously allow users, allow policies on top of that catch-all.
I mean, it's a classic firewall. Deny all, deny from anywhere
Correct.
rule, catch all, and then everything else is specified above that. It's interesting that that's not the default position for configuration. So, we are sort of going through time pretty quickly, but Fraser, I'm going to give you the last word here before we go to the Q&A function or the Q&A section. And let's go to the end. Let's if you suspect business email compromise, I've actually got two parts to this question. One, how are they, generally, how are they going to be picked up if they're not detected by the SOC? And then, secondly, what should you do? What's the actions that that you should take?
Of course. So if it's not picked up by the SOC, and that is, of course, rare scenarios, let's say it's laptop theft, et cetera, many of the ways that that's be detected is through users themselves. So it's always really important to ensure that, as Peter mentioned, that your staff are trained. They know exactly who to reach out to if they see something strange, see something, say something. Or as the British Transport love to say, see it, say it, sort it. So you need to pay close attention to any user reports for strange activity. Hey, I got this weird email from my boss. It's also really important to make sure that you're definitely pushing this training out to anyone who is senior. So those who have super admin, so to speak, anyone who can enact emergency changes, things like that, really important. Because giving them that training gives them the power to say, something's not right here. I know who to reach out to. Because your users are very much a part of your security controls, as well as, of course, the traditional tooling. One of the other things to make sure of in these situations, especially if you've already had a business email compromise, let's say a supplier reaches out and said, hey, we've had this, not sure if anyone from our organization has reached out, is to ensure that you've got checks and balances for all of these major things. For instance, if there's a large wire transfer, hey, this needs to be verified in person. Because of course, I think we all know with the rise of AI, if someone's a public speaker, it's very easy to duplicate their voice for a phone call purposes, have them sound agitated, have them speak quickly, and then have them hang up at the end. And most importantly, is to keep an eye out on your detections. As Peter mentioned, geofencing. If you don't have geofencing in place, if you're a multinational business, it can be very important to ensure that you're paying close attention to those authentication-based alerts. Someone logging in from a lot of countries at once, someone logging in risky user statuses with an Entra ID, of course, unfamiliar user agents, unfamiliar applications with an Entra ID. And of course, as mentioned earlier, ensure that you've also got internal playbooks for when these kind of things are identified to ensure that you're reaching out to the right person to get the right answer, whether that be a user's line manager, whether that be a user's colleague if the line manager's unavailable, just to verify for certain, hey, are you aware of this person traveling? Are you aware of this person making this change, for instance, if it's a new firewall rule, if it's a high impact change that's taken place, you need to make sure that it's something that's well communicated and well documented. And that's where it's also very handy to ensure that you're using ticket references as standard for these kind of changes, so that when something like this happens, there's a ticket number that can be provided. And then if the person doesn't have a ticket number that they're able to reference, that you're able to verify, it could be that they're an attacker, or it could be that they're working outside process and might need some more additional training there.
Yeah, and yeah, as equally as important as each other. Joel, there is I've been nudged I've forgotten our second poll, but there's something just before we jump into that, Rebecca, there was something that both yourself and Peter talked about, particularly around configuration. There's something that our Microsoft security team see quite often when they're doing security assessments and posture assessments, particularly of Entra, that a lot of those things we've talked about, being completely unknown that they are not configured correctly. So it's definitely something that if there's one action to take away from this, it's go and assess the configuration of those. So actually, which brings us probably on quite nicely to the poll question that we can pretty much finish on. So, Rebecca, if you want to launch our second poll, and it's, are you comfortable that your conditional access policies in your Microsoft tenant is appropriately set up? So, again, I'll
While
just give you
we,
a few seconds. Sorry, Martin.
yeah, while we get some input on that poll, I just wanted to point out a few things, and just add on to what some of the guys were talking about now. So first of all, when just to add on to the remediation, if you do see a business email compromise, the importance of not just resetting a password, but also resetting the session. In Entra, because if they are if they have stolen the token or a session, then they can log in even if the password has been changed. So it's important to reset those sessions or actually maintain their session, I should say. And that can often be the case. So it's very important to reset those sessions. We've had scenarios where customers, even see a phishing link and we pick it up and we tell them, well, these guys clicked on the link and the customer's not too concerned. It's, they say it's fine, we have 2FA. Well, if they've hijacked the session, then the 2FA is irrelevant and they can still log in. So reset those sessions if you, even if you're, not 100% certain, if you just think that that's the case, that the user's been compromised, reset those sessions. That's quite important to do that.
Yeah. No, indeed. So, Rebecca, we just have a look at the last poll here. So, very close to being 50-50 between yes and no, and sort of tipping in the yes side around the Microsoft tenant configuration. So, I think what we'll do now is I will just reshare my screen if I can figure out where I've lost my button here. Just so we can close out. So, firstly, just before I would before we jump into the Q&A, just remind everybody we do have some upcoming webinars and events. So, we have a webinar coming up on the 5th of February, which is really untangling, so looking at compliance, untangling compliance in 2026. And probably the biggest thing we can chat about is our Security First conferences that we'll be running around each of our regions across the globe, where we're bringing thought leadership. And experts talk about all the topics that that we need to for this year, focusing resilience redefined and securing the human AI era. So if we move on to the Q&A now and see what questions we have in, and again if I can get my Zoom controls back, we have one question in the Q&A, and that is and please feel free to drop some questions in there and put our team to the test. But the first question there is adopting zero trust going to solve BEC? I don't know who wants to take that question first.
I can take an initial stab at it. So solve, possibly not. You've got to remember that some of these attacks are very sophisticated. These people are con men by trade. They're very confident. They're very good at misleading users. If they're taking the form of an IT admin, they could be out of band on the phone with the user via WhatsApp, Signal, Telegram, giving them instructions on what to click and where to click, telling them to go through different portions of that zero trust profile. But it will stop some of your more opportunistic attackers, some of your less sophisticated threat groups, criminals, etc.
Yeah, I think zero trust again is going to be a big topic. It's kind of come back round again. You know, it's completed the hype cycle of just being a marketing buzzword into something that that you know is expected. This is the year that everyone will start to actually implement fully a zero trust architecture. And you know, a part of that is that conditional access that we're talking about, that constant verification. You know, if you look at one of the core principles, is not just authenticating, is re-authenticating, validating, and authorizing on access, which is one of the things that they're bypassing with that session hijacking and token hijacking. So, so again, you know, like you say, Fraser, not something that is going to, you know, there's no silver bullet, and I think that's probably a lesson in life there.
I think we learned that when we realized MFA wasn't the silver bullet, because all we have to do is rewind 5 years, and you know we still had this phishing problem, and we were like, no, let's roll out MFA, and we did a great job of that eventually, but here we sit with the attackers bypassing MFA. So cat and mouse game, eh?
Yeah, indeed. Just another question just popped in there. Multiple layers have been discussed: people, process, and technology. At the technology layer, specific to email security vendor products, which are excelling? Is multiple layers of email security products now mandatory?
So,
Go ahead, Fraser.
of course, I just want to speak to the second point. And the second point is multiple layers. I would say very close to mandatory. One of the things that I've noticed in quite a few environments in my time in industry is that a lot of people will have an external email gateway, but will have no record of internal emails available in their SIEM or whichever product it is they use for their security. So you can see if someone gets compromised, they might launch an internal campaign that could go undetected by their controls. Sorry about that, Martin.
Yeah, no, I was just saying that, you know, everyone's talking about consolidation nowadays. So to bring this into the mix and say that you need another product is nice, but I don't think everyone's going to buy it. I would say that there are some products that are excelling. Actually, when we were talking about the mitigation, Microsoft have added new log streams or log events and capabilities, also with conditional access, that allows you to do that. But yeah, I think if you can, great. And some of these technologies are drilling into the mail and analyzing patterns, and you know, taking a little bit further than just looking at the from and the to and the subject and URLs. They're kind of analyzing that to a deeper level. So certainly those products are doing a lot better at identifying these. And if you can have multiple products, budgets allow for that, certainly that's probably where I would prioritize, purely because that is where we are seeing the attacks. And for me, it lines up to attacks on identities, which we know is a huge thing, because these are just identities being stolen in the essence here.
Yeah, and yeah, I mean, I'm on Fraser's side. I appreciate there's a consolidation, and maybe it's looking at vendors that can do both. But you know, we can't chuck our secure email gateways in the bin, because they're our first line of defense. But it's, you know, important that we have an integrated email security solution. You know, things like Darktrace's anti-Gina for email that is, you know, focusing on the inbox, the activity within there, to be able to identify malicious activity. So just we'll jump. There's one more question that's just popped in that we'll try and get to. And Peter, I see you come off mute to answer questions, and we didn't give you the opportunity. So maybe you want to jump into this one. So have you seen any instances where AI usage in inboxes was abused to extract info or evolving BEC attacks, or abusing the AI agent sessions?
Use of AI, definitely. Abusing AI agent sessions, I can't say for certain. But yes, we have seen instances of crafted emails and more flourished emails, I think is a good way to say it, where AI has now spruced them up. You know, they're not looking as bad, and they're looking a lot better and crafted, to try and confuse the attackers, you know, completely mimicking a third-party suppliers or internal users' writing style, as well as their logos and everything they use in the mails. Yes, I think we have seen that. We've also seen some very bad implementations of it, of threat actors trying to use it and failing miserably, which is always gives us a chuckle and raises our morale in the sock that it's not that far advanced yet, but I definitely think it's on the way. And we definitely have to keep our eye on it.
Yeah, I was just going to add to that. As advanced as the some of these attacks look, there are two the there's tool Peter had the name of some of these toolkits. I mean, these toolkits you can literally download and run one or two scripts, and you can have a website that will act as a man in the middle proxy, look exactly like Microsoft. It's not really sophisticated for anyone to get up. So, and it's the bulk of the attacks that are using these. So, for someone to log in and exploit any kind of AI that might be linked to that user account, surely not unheard of. But most of the attacks we are seeing, they're doing the same things. The how they attack is a little bit different. But once they get access, they're doing the things that they did 5 years ago, which is get the mail, get the address book, send out the mails to those users, spread, get more credentials. Often there's access brokers involved here that are the first part of the attack is just getting access and getting the credentials, and then they'll sell those credentials to other threat actors. And yeah, so it's in some sense unsophisticated because these toolkits make it so easy for these threat actors to launch these attacks. But for sure, we will see it. And if you look at more advanced attacks, more targeted attacks, no doubt that they will make use of any kind of areas where they can exploit.
Yeah, and I think going back to that example that Fraser gave about pinging on Teams, are you in Nigeria? And actually, the account's completely compromised. And the answer is yes. Well, you probably take that one step further. It's something we'll probably start seeing. People that have the top level Copilot license. So you've got Copilot built into Outlook that can analyze emails for you. I mean, there's a tool that's available to do that analysis of actually how does email writing being able to dive down and pull information out very, very quickly beyond what you can do with a search function of looking for keywords. So I expect that's something that will start to be utilized more and more, particularly as more and more people invest in enabling AI for their users overall. So I think we are pretty much exactly on the hour now. So I'm just going to say thank you to everybody that has joined today for this session to look at business email compromise, and also thank all of my panelists for all of their insightful inputs. So thank you very much, and hope to see you on our next webinar.
Cheers.
Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you very much.